Welcome, everyone, and thank you for coming this morning. Is there anybody who is first time today? Oh, okay, so this is what we call a Dharma talk. Dharma just it means many things, but it's a Sanskrit word that really refers to the whole body of the Buddhist teachings. And so usually on Sundays, after the meditation, there is a talk dealing with some aspect of the Buddhist teaching. And there will be an opportunity at the end, if you have any questions about what has been said, not just only in terms of our understanding of it, but also, most importantly, is how we practice it. Because as you know, Buddhism is a, when I say Buddhism, we're talking about a body of ideas, teachings, and most importantly, a body of practice, things that one does that has been worked upon for thousands of years by people just like us in many different places and cultures and times. So we cannot leave these teachings on the shelf. They have to be taken out and practiced. So the most important thing at the end of a Dharma talk is that one leaves it with some clarity about how to bring these practices and teachings into their life. Because we are here, why? Because we want to be happier human beings. We want to be better human beings. We want to be have more peaceful minds. We want to have greater meaning. All good things. Unfortunately, we cannot accomplish that just by listening to a Dharma talk or reading a book. We can only accomplish that by practicing, by doing it. So let me just say before I begin, I think many of you know, over these past months and weeks, we have been looking at a body of teaching related to the what are called the hindrances and the and then the factors of awakening. And again, our focus is on awakening. Our focus is on waking up. You know, when you are having a nightmare or just some kind of crazy dream, you are very happy when you wake up and realize it was just a dream. Instantaneously, immediately, there is relief. And in that relief is also happiness. That what we thought when we were in the dream was real was really not real. So in the same way, many of us, our lives, are in a certain way have become bad dreams. And not necessarily only because terrible things are happening. For some people, that happens. And most of us, at some point in the life, things like that happen. But just for many of us on an ongoing basis, even if our life is good, there is often something incomplete, something missing, something just not right. And we know that because we are not happy. And I don't mean just happy when we're doing fun things. Happy meaning from the time we wake up in the morning to the time we go to bed and as we go through our day. And when I'm saying happiness, it doesn't mean, you know, like a joke, like a jokester. It means a deep sense of well-being and ease. And a capacity just to go through one's day with equanimity, taking pleasure in things as they arise. And even when things arise that aren't very pleasurable, we have a way of dealing with these things, that they do not destroy our well-being, our happiness, or our equanimity. So this is what we want to do. We want to wake up from a bad dream, and we want to be able to really become our potential, the potential of all human beings. To be a Buddha simply means you have realized your potential. That is why in Buddhism it is said everyone has the potentiality of being a Buddha. And this is important to understand. Let me just say before I jump in, what I want to say was I think many of you know that on Thursdays in these last month we've begun to have these forums and then also these extended sitting periods. The forums have been very interesting. We've had two on sexuality, and the last one we had on the use of intoxicants. And I think this is important because as Americans who are interested in learning about this ancient tradition and the teachings and practices within it, the important thing is that we also utilize these things we're learning in terms of looking at our culture and the kind of things that are going on in our culture and the kind of things that Buddhism and this way of looking at things and mindfulness may contribute to the dialogue. And so we've had some very interesting, very open dialogues on intoxicants and sexuality, and we will continue over the coming months every other week to pick some topic that is relevant to our culture and invite, that's what we call it, a forum. It's not a formal teaching. I do begin the discussion by presenting something, but it's really more just to get people cooking, and then it's a very open open discussion. The main thing in Buddhist teachings in relationship to the world and the issues of the world is to do no harm, to do the least harm. And so whether we are looking at issues of sexuality, whether we're looking at issues of intoxicants, the fundamental principle is always not to do harm to oneself, and especially not to do harm to anyone else. And so when we look at it that way, all of a sudden, we have some understanding about how to proceed. But there's really, I think, in our society, a third aspect, which is, what kind of person do I want to be? What do I want to stand for in this life? Right. Not just in terms of my ideas, but how I am in the world, how I am in relationships with others, how I am within my family and my friendships, how I am at the workplace, how I am as I move about this world. You know, what do I stand for? Because the practices, like in relationship to even the things we just talked about, is we are also, each of us, in a certain way, examples to others, whether we want to be or not. And how we carry on, how we behave, how we communicate, the things we talk about, how we respond or don't respond to situations, has a great effect on other people. So again, mindfulness opens our eyes to really seeing clearly those around us, ourselves, and again, the effects of the actions of our bodies, of our words and our mind. We are often even people who have a yearning, a thirst for a more developed life. Even people who have a yearning or a thirst for a better world often see it, you know, big picture, kind of big picture in the sense of politics or social movements or things like that, and don't see it as simple as my own behavior, my own actions, the way I relate, the way I speak, the way I act, the way I think. Because for better or worse, each of us is the world. And the healing and the transformation of the world is related to the healing and transformation of each person in the world. So that sort of gives us, you know, a sort of a sense of responsibility that we take our own responsibility to the world, to each other, again, with some kind of a sense of interrelationship. Thich Nhat Hanh calls it interbeing, interconnection, non-separation. And we understand, again, in a certain way, all our actions, and even our times when we don't act, are sending out little ripples into the ocean of the world. And we want our ripples to be good ones, to be helpful. And in no way do we want our ripples to be things that are contributing to the suffering, the difficulty, the pain that is so present in the world. And I know we all feel that way. So what we've been talking about in these past months are the seven factors of awakening. And the last weeks I've been talking about the first three, mindfulness, investigation, deep looking, and diligence. But before I go on to the next four, I want to take a little break and add an eighth. But we'll put it in parentheses. Because I think it is understood, but it is sometimes, if it is not stated clearly, it may be overlooked. If one is leading an awakened life, and that mindfulness, concentration, the capacity always to be looking more deeply into situations within ourselves and with others, are really looking for meaning and looking for, you know, is it true? a willingness to look at our thoughts and the stories that our mind often tells us and asking, is it true? What is the origin of this? What are the source of this? Who is this person I'm really talking to? Even the person I may be angry at. Am I willing to look deeply into their situation to understand them deeper? And if there is greater ease and understanding in one's life. But most importantly, if one is diminishing a traditional life of egocentricity. Egocentricity means what? That everything in my life is centered on who? On me. And that every situation I'm in, every relationship I'm in, everything I look at is always filtered through me. And looking at everything through me is a very little narrow chink to look at the world. So we want to have a broader view. And the broader view is to come out of this world of egocentricity, narcissism, making everything about me. I mean, we often say, don't take it personally, right? There's a lot of truth in that. Of course, we take everything personally. That's our problem. When we take everything personally and everything filters through the me and the I and the self, there will be endless drama, endless emotionality, endless up and down, endless happiness and unhappiness, disappointment, success, failure. I mean, it's endless, that world. But when we break out of it, when we diminish the hold of the self and seeing everything through I, me, my, one notices what? That I am not just this, but I am that. And that doesn't just include this. It includes the trees and flowers and water and air and mountains. And when one begins to not experience life through this very narrow chink, but experiences one's connection with all life, and this is what I want to talk about, then naturally, and that's why I don't think it's said in these seven factors of awakening, naturally, what occurs is one's relationship to life becomes one of kindness, caring, compassion, acceptance. So because that is considered, I think, a natural part of how the awakened mind conducts itself in life, it is not stated. So I just want to take this time today to talk about that. Cultivating these seven factors of awakening, as we've discussed and will be continued to discuss, are all going on within the context of our life. They're practices that we do in a meditative way that relate to our minds. But since we are not hermits, since we do not dwell away from life, we are lay people. We are fully involved. We are fully invested in life. And so if our meditative, quote, spiritual dharma practice, whatever you want to call it, has any meaning, it has to have meaning in how we conduct ourselves in life, which means how we relate to everything and everyone. Well, again, do unto others as you've want others to do unto you. Because it is clear, right? If we ask ourselves, how would I like everybody in the world to treat me? I would say what? I mean, wouldn't we love everyone to treat us with kindness, with caring, with compassion if we're suffering? Wouldn't we like everybody to be understanding of us and accepting of us as we are? Of course we would. I mean, actually, no matter how off the wall we are, we always get very hurt or frustrated or irritated if people don't act that way to us, don't we? We want those around us to treat us that way. That is proof that there's a part of us that knows what is best for human beings, because we know that is best for ourselves. Right? I mean, if anybody said, yeah, I mean, if I could choose a relationship, I would love to find somebody who's always critical of me, never accepting, never understanding, always points out my faults, is never supportive, never kind. Right? We laugh. Because we know, no, that's not what we say. That's not what we want in our relationships. Whether it's in our family relationships, our intimate relationships, our relationships with people at work, you know. So Buddhism teaches what are called the four immeasurables, the four boundless states. And they are states that are natural, indigenous to the mind and heart of each one of us. It is nothing foreign. It is nothing that has to be manufactured. But because many of us, that part of ourselves has not been nurtured, that part of ourselves has not been pointed out, or because life has perhaps beaten us up a little bit, or disappointed us, or hardened us, we don't trust that. Or if we do, we only trust it in very narrow places. We don't see that fundamental open-heartedness to life and all beings is fundamental to our true mind. There was a time for each of us when we were little, when we had that relationship to the world. We just looked and we smiled and we responded with openness. And we all began at that place. And one of the purposes of our practice is to return to that with, you know, the discriminating understanding or sophistication or intelligence of an adult. There is something to be said for maturity, which is a little beyond the innocence of a child. But at the same time, to understand that the fundamental capacity to be in life open-heartedly is the true source of happiness. The more guarded we are, the more shut down we are, the more narrow we are, the more untrusting we are, the unhappier we are. It is something that we can feel. And we all know that, right? The first aspect of what are these called, these four immeasurables, is the word is metta. And it means loving kindness, right? It means friendship. It is that attitude of mind, you know, again, that we all know when we have a friend. When we have a friend, we treat them in what way? How do we treat them?
Kindness.
Kindness, right? How else do we treat them? We accept them. We're happy to see them. We smile when we see them. We don't frown. When we see it's when our caller ID says it's our good friend on the phone, we're happy. We pick it right up. We're happy to talk to them. They're our friend, right? We want them to be happy. We don't want bad things to happen to our friends, do we? No. We want good things to happen to our friends. We want life to work out for them, right? So can you see that that those qualities of mind and relationship which we bring to our friendships, which again may be, you know, we can count on one or two hands, right? Where we really have that. What we're talking about is beginning to break down the barriers and to realize that why I am friendly to a few, maybe a little bit to others, and indifferent to most is because of the conditioning that my mind has received over time, the conditioning that my heart has received over time. It has closed down over time. It has narrowed over time. It is a unconscious training that our heart has received. But knowing about the practices of loving kindness, and that we can begin to more consciously open, is a wonderful practice. That's why the practice of loving kindness is one of the essential practices within the Buddhist tradition. And you know, there's a sutra, a teaching of the Buddha called the Metta Sutra, and Tim's not here today, you know, but those who've been here over these past months, one of our members is a musician. He's taken what's called the Loving Kindness Sutra and put some of it to music. You know, it's good wishes for myself. May I be happy. May I be free of suffering. Right? May you be happy. May you be free of suffering. May the world be happy, right? All. May anybody who is experiencing difficulty, may they be free of difficulty. May anybody who's experiencing, you know, afflictive mind states of anger and fear and sadness, may they all be free of it, right? Now again, you know, that's easy. You see, there are a lot of people who say, oh, well, I do a lot of loving kindness meditation, right? Oh, yeah, I do a lot of loving kindness meditation, you know, on the mat. You know, when it comes to people, oh, that's something totally different, you know? Yeah. We don't get credit for our loving kindness meditation on the mat, in the Dharma hall, in the privacy of our homes. We get credit for our loving kindness meditation with human beings. And the more difficult a human being is to love, to like, again, I have to erase love, to like, the more credit we get. Because, again, this is not just esoteric. We all know this. Anybody here, let's say, have friends or family members that they consider their friends. All right. When you hear, first of all, are they all saints? What? Are they all saints? Does everybody think they're as wonderful as you do? No. Right? Some of them may be real jerks. Some of them may do not nice things. Right? And yet, you don't abandon them. You always try to understand them. You always look to the good in them. You always want to support them, right? Why? Because they're my friend, right? Because they're family. So that shows us that we have the capacity, each of us, and have done it, to generate loving kindness, caring, compassion, understanding, all these things, to people that are really objectively not that nice, or that other people might find to be pains, right? But we think, you know, oh, but that's just the way they are, right? Yeah, we understand, but that's just the way they are. Or we'll say, well, you know, they've had a difficult time. Maybe that's why they did it. Right? They're going through a hard time. But if somebody else acts in a certain way, we don't extend that understanding. We don't extend that patience, right? We're judgmental. We're harsh. Again, so the practice of loving kindness is a willingness to take, and again, everybody here knows how to practice loving kindness, right? But it's a willingness to see that the narrowness, the way we express it, the way we pick and choose, is just our own delusions, our own conditioning. And it is robbing us of knowing what it's like to have an open heart. It feels differently than a narrow heart, than a wounded heart. Is that clear? For many of us, that may sound a little risky. But I assure you, that the practice of loving kindness has always, always been expressed as one of the most wonderful things that one can do for one's mental health. And most of us hopefully care about our mental health, don't we? We care about our physical health. And if somebody tells us, if you stop doing this and start doing that, you will feel much better in terms of your physical health, we will often do it, won't we? Yeah. Oh, thank you for the advice. I'll start doing that exercise program, or going to that Pilates something or other, you know, or I'll start taking those supplements. Thank you. You know, we are. You know, if someone tells us something that is for that we think is for our physical benefit, you know, we often jump right on it. But when somebody tells us something that is good intrinsically for our mind, that can affect us throughout our day, we're much more cautious. We are much less attentive. And yet, at the end of the day, it is the well-being of our minds. It is the health of our minds that is most essential. So again, the first is metta, or loving kindness. I have a new granddaughter, and her name is Metta. The second is karuna. Karuna means compassion, so it's different. It's different than loving kindness in the Buddhist teachings on love, because compassion directly relates to the condition of suffering, and suffering, we know, is. It is something that is very present in life. Whether it is the sufferings that happen from just the natural disasters, whether it's the sufferings that are made, you know, as human beings harm each other, or whether it's the self-created sufferings of one's own mind. Suffering human beings, suffering planet, suffering animals, suffering is a fact of this world. And so how does one relate to that? Right? So compassion in Buddhism, karuna, implies two things, which is very important. Because many people think compassion equals empathy. In Buddhism, empathy is half of what karuna means. The first half is empathy, which means that capacity, again, and we have to come out of ourself. Many people, we are only concerned with who's suffering. You know, we are primarily empathic with who's suffering. Right? It may be a few others. But to most people, we are indifferent, if we are honest. Thich Nhat Hanh has recently said, how can we expect the people of this world to deal with the great suffering of the planet? Right? The great suffering of sustainability and resources, all these things. How can we expect people to deal with this big suffering if they don't even acknowledge and take care of their own suffering? So empathy is the first thing, to begin to be present to, you know, one's own suffering, but also the suffering of others. To notice when people are suffering, not to be indifferent, and to feel connected. Now, the second half of karuna is what's very key in Buddhism, is the desire to liberate that suffering, that person who's suffering. Okay? That is the natural next step that just flows, right? Right? This morning, I think I got bit by a spider, right? And lo and behold, what did this kind right hand do? It went over and kind of rubbed it. That was quite kind of it, wasn't it? It saw that this hand was suffering, and even though it wasn't suffering, it still reached over to ease the suffering of the left hand. That is compassion. It didn't just say, oh, sorry you're suffering, but I have, you know, other things to do. Or, sorry you're suffering, gee, am I happy that I'm not. It didn't even say it. It was just natural. It just reached over and rubbed it. That shows us that even a physical body, when parts of it are suffering, spontaneously and naturally move to take care of it. We all know, that's the way we're hardwired, right? Our body with our immune system, right? Compassion is hardwired into our physical bodies, right? Which is incredible, right? When part of the body is in difficulty, the other part of the bodies, activate themselves, right? To help out. That is, so again, we call it compassion, but that's what we're talking about. Right? So that we move, obviously, beyond indifference to empathy, but we move beyond empathy to action. The first one we have to be compassionate toward is what? Or whom? Ourselves. Right? ourselves. When we are suffering, when we are unhappy, when our minds are agitated, etc., etc., we are suffering. And we have to be able to be empathic to that within us that is suffering. And we have to immediately follow up with, how can I help? What can I do to relieve the suffering? And then we move out, because we notice that what? That I am not the only one suffering, am I? There are other people in my life who are suffering. There are other people in my neighborhood who are suffering. There are people that I may just see when I'm out and about who are suffering. And rather than being indifferent to it, and rather than being overwhelmed by it, I'm willing to notice it and to name it. And if there's anything that I can do to help, I will do it, right? That's a compassionate person. Does anybody here know in their life a compassionate person? Yeah. Do you like them? Yeah. We like them. Why do we like them? Because they're a compassionate person. Oh. Usually compassionate people are nice people to have around in our life, aren't they? Yeah. Right. Again, one knows that. Right? So therefore, in this practice, we take upon ourselves the intention, the aspiration to be what? To be a compassionate human being. And to extend that out as far and wide as we can. If the world had more compassionate human beings, if the world had more human beings who consistently practice loving kindness, and less human beings who consistently practice anger, hatred, violence, we'd have a very different world, wouldn't we? So the power of loving kindness and compassion should not be overlooked if we are seeking greater well-being and healing and mental health for ourselves, but also for the world. Are there any questions? Why don't we take a few minutes? I mean, just any real questions that you have about either these teachings or about real situations. I mean, if you think this is all kind of airy-fairy and fluffy-wuffy and oopy-gooey or something, you know, but has no relationship to the, you know, if you think it's a jungle out there, and if you are this way, you'll just get eaten by the lions, please say yes.
I feel a lot of compassion for the homeless and for what's going on around the world, the wildlife that's affected by the choice of community. So I think my problems are that I struggle not to get depressed about it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be very positive as a person. I take action involved political things, climate change,
mm-hmm.
and all
things. Mm-hmm. So let me just repeat the question, because it's being videoed. So the question is, what is your name?
Mary.
So Mary says, you know, I see myself as a compassionate person, and I'm very active in many ways and in trying to alleviate, but my problem is it's often overwhelming to me, and it can be depressing or, you know, really get one down. Yeah, you're absolutely right. So it's very interesting. In traditional Buddhism, in the iconography of traditional Buddhism, there is what's called the Bodhisattva of Compassion, right? Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. It really means an enlightened being, but it's a representative. So there are images, statues, paintings of the Bodhisattva of Compassion, this enlightened being of compassion. Actually, there's a wonderful representation, which is called the Thousand-Armed Avalokiteshvara. If you've ever seen that image. It's a statue and has 1,000 arms, showing that, the true compassionate being, is constantly reaching out in many, 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 many ways. I mean, 1,000 arms is only because it's hard to, make a statue with 10,000 arms or 1,000,000 arms, but they do make them with 1,000 arms, quite something. The interesting thing is, if you look at those representations, you will see that in their hand there is an eye. It's very important. There is an eye. And that is the eye of wisdom and understanding. This is very central. So what you're talking about has been, dealt with for thousands of years, okay? And what that means is our compassion has to also have wisdom in it, okay? Or else, on the one hand, it can become sentimentality or what we call codependence, right? You think you're helping something, but you're just making it worse, or you're just facilitating dysfunction. Or on the other hand, you could just be overwhelmed. So understanding means, at the same time, one is empathic and one wants to help. One understands the situation, right? And if I said to you, Mary, all these things that are concern you in the world, do you understand why they are in the world? What? Do you understand why the causes and conditions that have created these situations, that things are unfolding the way they are? Do you understand it? Well, not that big. No, I'm not going that big. I mean, so pick an issue. An issue might be that concerns you. Climate change, okay. Do you have an understanding of why that is an issue? Why the climate is changing for the worse? Do you understand the causes of that?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so you understand causes. So you understand how we got here. Okay. Why do you think we got here?
You want me to say what I think?
Yeah. Just quickly. Yeah, we can't not get in a hole. Because people...
Addiction to convenience.
Yeah, not seeing the big picture. Yeah, not seeing the big picture, only my own narrow needs, my own convenience. Right. All the stuff that all of us know. Right. So you understand, when you look at causes, this is why we're having this problem. Whether it's a problem that affects the whole world, like global warming, or whether it's a problem that's just affecting you and other people who are close to you. Right? When you see suffering, you look for causation. Right. So when you act wisely, right? Wisely means I'm also looking at what causes it. And if you're saying you understand that behind, this overuse of resource, et cetera, lies what? Greed, narrowness, not seeing cause and effect, all those things, you realize it's only going to change when that changes, right? And so you come back to the human beings, right? And you understand things are the way they are because human beings are the way they are, right? And that's the job. So your compassion keeps you connected and wanting to do something. But the you getting depressed doesn't help the world, does it?
Yeah.
Right. So you wanna, that's why you want the big picture. And understand, yeah, this is, you know, greed, narrowness, self-interest, you know, childish kind of not seeing, you know, teenagers, right? Right. Teenagers are all about what?
Yeah.
Self and, you know, what's going on right now. I mean, right, and the hardest trouble parents and teachers have with teenagers is kind of getting to think that, you know, there may be a future out there. That actions have consequences, right? I mean, that's, you know, that's why it's very frustrating to parents and teachers working with teenagers, right?
Yeah.
So it's like that. I mean, you know, you unfortunately, we have a world where most people have not developed too much beyond that. And that's just the way it is, isn't it? So teachers and parents don't give up on their kids, do they?
No.
No, they keep working it. So it's like that. That's where the understanding balances the compassion. So it doesn't become, again, overly sentimental. It doesn't become kind of, again, just kind of blind, not seeing what's really going on. And when you see what's going on and you see the job ahead of you, you know, you act accordingly.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's. I mean, that's why, again, that's why it's so important for people who are in fields of dealing with suffering, whether it's people dealing very directly in their work or whatever, or in families, or people dealing with trying to make some effective changes in the suffering of the world, have this perspective. So we can, you know, the world doesn't need, what do they call it, compassion fatigue? I remember years ago they used to call, is that still around? They call compassion fatigue, yeah. Again, compassion, an open heart, a compassionate heart, is boundless, is an endless source of good energy, right? It only gets fatigued if it's narrowed by a self that wants a certain outcome, right? You know, that's where we get hung up, right? We give up because, you know, our ego said, you know, doing all this work, it should produce the result I want. But, you know, there it is, right? And so when we have understanding, we understand it doesn't always work that way, or it rarely works that way. So that's why in Buddhism it said all our actions, all our good actions, are done without attachment to outcome. It's a very it's difficult for us because we are very attached to outcome, aren't we? Right? I mean, we set goals and objectives, and we are expected, if we, you know, follow through, we'll achieve our goal. And we get very easily frustrated when we do it all right, and yet it doesn't change because we're attached to outcome. And there are too many variables out there. So we have to do the work in a very personal way. We do it because that's the way to do it. Right? We're compassionate people just because that's the way to be. And whether the person changes or doesn't change, or, you know, whether the suffering changes or not, you know, we want it to, but it may not. Right? Anybody ever here try to help somebody who's suffering and they don't respond? Yeah. So, you know, that's just the way it is, isn't it? And then if you understand they are who they are, you understand their causes and conditions or whatever it is, you know, it's the way it is, as we say. Any more? We should probably be stopping. Are there any other questions? Yes.
So we're just being compassionate without expecting anything in return.
Exactly. Well said. We are being compassionate without expecting anything in return. Yeah, isn't there like a saying that we have in our culture, goodness is its own reward, or something is its own reward? What is that?
Yeah, something like that.
Virtue is its own reward. So it's like that, right? Again, we have to understand that these things that we call compassion or kindness, or these are natural conditions of the heart that spontaneously arise. They only get distorted or thwarted or shut down because of conditions and situations in life that wound us. And we have to free ourselves from these woundings so we can return to the fundamental basic goodness of our hearts, which is always here. And again, like we said earlier, to be an open person and a loving person and a caring person and a compassionate person, just from a purely selfish point of view, feels good. It feels much better than the other way, right? I mean, how many people enjoy being pissed and angry? Only Gary. Yeah, it's kind of a no-brainer when you look at it that way, isn't it? Yeah, but we don't look at it that way. So good. We will stop. Thank you.